The exhibit opens to the public in 3 weeks. Mr. Mizrani wanted me to consult with you. We'd like you to evaluate the paddock for vulnerabilities.
Why me?
I guess Mr. Mizrani thinks since you're able to control the raptors.
See, it's all about control with you. I don't control the raptors. It's a relationship. It's based on mutual respect.
A new Jurassic Park movie comes out next month, and once again, clone dinosaurs will wreak havoc on scientists who really should have known better. But what if we really could bring back raptors, or mammoths, or dodos? We'll consider the possibilities later in today's show. First, though, the Los Angeles City Council is debating right now whether to increase the city's minimum wage to $15 an hour by the year 2020. That's considerably higher than either the state or federal minimum wage. We commonly think of people making the minimum wage as the lowest paid workers. It is the minimum wage, after all. But one study suggests that a third of all workers in Los Angeles actually make less than minimum. Tia Kuntz has been studying this. She's legal and policy research manager at the UCLA Labor Center. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Madeline. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, I'm so happy to have you. A third making less than the minimum wage? How do you know that?
We know that from conducting exhaustive surveys of over 1,800 low-wage workers in Los Angeles as part of a three-city study that we conducted. We published our study in 2010, and we surveyed collectively over 5,000 people in Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York. So we know that in Los Angeles today, nearly 30% of low-wage workers are not even making the minimum wage. We did not rely on them to have any knowledge of what the minimum wage actually was or any wage and hour laws whatsoever. We surveyed them about their working conditions, what they were making, how many hours they were working, and then we did the math. So we know it's accurate, and it's pretty wild, isn't it?
Yeah, it is pretty wild. And is it per hour they're not making the minimum wage, or are they not making overtime, just working long hours?
That's a great question. So 30% are making less than minimum wage. 80% who work overtime are not getting paid overtime rates of pay. 70% of folks that we interviewed, 70% of low-wage workers in LA right now are working off the clock, often for no pay of any kind. 80% are working through meal and rest breaks. And another 45% are experiencing illegal deductions from their pay, frequently in the form of managers or employers dipping into the tip jar.
So restaurant workers, for example?
Yeah, for example, yeah. Although we know that that's been dominating a lot of the conversation lately as we look at raising the minimum wage and how the city should address tip credits or tipped workers. But it's really important, I think, for your listeners to understand that tipped workers are not just restaurant workers in the city. They're also nail salon workers and car wash workers and valet parkers. And actually, more than 50% of tipped workers in LA are not restaurant workers. So it's a pretty diverse pool, and 45% of them are getting their tips stolen.
So which are the main industries where people are making less than the minimum wage?
Yeah, so some of them are not going to be a real surprise to you, right? They're kind of classic bad actors. So the garment industry, well over half of Los Angeles garment workers are making less than minimum wage at 58%. Wow. And that's a lot of workers, because in Los Angeles, we have more garment workers than any other city in the country, right? It's a huge manufacturing sector. Domestic workers are making 35% of domestic workers in LA are making less than minimum wage, followed right behind by building services, by which I mean custodial workers and security guards, followed by retail and car wash. But it's actually a pretty wide array of industries. So like I said, some of them are you know, not going to be major surprises, but others of them might be a surprise to people. Retail, for example, pretty big heavy hitter. Restaurants and hotels, nearly 20% of folks in LA working in restaurants and hotels are not making minimum wage.
So is that all illegal? And if so, how do they get away with it, the employers?
Yeah, of course this is illegal, right? And whenever I talk to anybody about this, that's kind of the first thing they ask me is, isn't there a law? How do they get away with this? Because it happens so, so regularly. And a lot of these employers, this is actually their business practice, right? Like their entire business practice is undercapitalized and is predicated on never making payroll legally. And they get away with it because, unfortunately, you know, our state enforcement system is chronically underfunded and under-resourced. There's about 60 investigators statewide to go out and investigate on the ground. So really the kind of dirty secret is that enforcing wage and hour laws is up to the worker, who can file a claim, or if she's lucky enough to know a lawyer or be able to hire a lawyer in order to go after the wages that she's owed against her employer. But even then, the likelihood that she can actually collect on her final judgment for unpaid wages is just 17%.
I imagine a lot of these workers are undocumented as well, and they're afraid to speak up because they're afraid of being deported.
Oh my gosh, the chilling effect that being undocumented has cannot be overstated. And I think I do want to clarify for your listeners, this is something that I just experience a lot of misinformation, like across education levels, across class levels, across immigration status levels. Being undocumented does not mean you don't get paid for your work. You are treated exactly the same under the law, regardless of your immigration status, right? Like, we did away with free labor like 150 years ago. But obviously, you're not going to go and file a claim if you're afraid of being deported. And in fact, 45% of low-wage workers in LA who do speak up to their boss or do file a claim experience retaliation, and the number one form of retaliation is threats to be fired or to have ICE called on you. So, of course, being undocumented is going to play into this.
What about the people who, the employers, is there some kind of profiling of the type of people who underpay? And I'm also wondering if, you know, what about a small, business person who's maybe just trying to get their business off the ground? Maybe they've just immigrated here and they just can't afford to pay minimum wage. Maybe they're just, making tacos on the side of the street and they are employing their neighbor for less than minimum wage, stories
sure.
like that.
So, yeah, let's talk about employers. I'm glad you asked. And in fact, it's actually employer characteristics that are far likelier to predict wage theft. So oftentimes we think that this is an immigration issue and really it needs to be solved, in the White House, and we need to solve our broken immigration system because so many undocumented workers are exploited in the workplace. And while that's certainly true, we know that actually it's characteristics of an employer that are four times likelier to predict a minimum wage or an overtime violation, for example. So it's type of industry, how big your industry is, whether or not you're paid in cash. Those are all employer characteristics, and those drive whether or not somebody experiences wage theft. Size of an employer does drive some of that, and you've asked specifically about like immigrant entrepreneurs, of which we have many in Los Angeles, right? We estimate that we have over 50,000 street vendors, for example, who may or may not actually have employees, right? I mean, many of these folks are entrepreneurs who are self-employed and working just by themselves. Mm-hmm. Many do, in fact, hire their neighbor. And when we go up raising our minimum wage, those employers are going to have to somehow dig into their pockets to be able to afford to pay their neighbor adequately. Those employers are definitely, skirting the law a little bit. That said, the vast majority of the wage theft that I'm talking about occurs at the hands of larger employers with 25 and up.
Yeah. And it's not just immigrants, right, who are the victims of this?
No, absolutely not. In fact, African-American workers are twice as likely as their white counterparts to experience a minimum wage violation. Asian-American workers, regardless of their immigration status, experience the highest rates of off-the-clock and overtime at 84% and 82%, respectively, violations. Women, in particular, experience wage violations at a higher rate than their male counterparts. So, again, we do talk about this as an immigrant rights issue, and it 100% is, but the face of wage theft is really, it's the face of L.A. I mean, everybody experiences it in low-wage industries. It's just kind of par for the course.
So what do you think about the minimum wage? Do you think that if it is raised, it'll put pressure on this underground economy for the employees to raise the sub-minimum wage that they're paying?
Without enforcement, absolutely not. Without enforcement, absolutely not. And that's why all eight cities in California who've raised their minimum wage have included a local enforcement authority. So the classic example is San Francisco, who was one of the first two cities in the country to raise their minimum wage back in 2003. It was San Francisco and Santa Fe, actually. And they created an Office of Labor Standards Enforcement. And that office has been wildly successful. That office has collected all of the unpaid wages plus interest owed to workers since 2003. It's collected 90.5% of the unpaid wages and interest, which is really, really high by comparison to the State Bureau of Field Enforcement, which collects unpaid wages at a rate of about 48%. So we know that local enforcement is pretty effective, and it's one of the reasons why City Council is going to be creating an Office of Labor Standards Enforcement. It's my understanding, according to motions out of the Economic Development Committee over the course of the last few weeks. And that's really going to help ensure that we're not just raising the minimum wage, we're also enforcing it.
Yeah.
And
okay.
That's going to go a long way towards actually lifting Angelinos out of poverty, right?
All right. We have to run. Unfortunately, Tia Kuntz, Legal and Policy Research Manager at the UCLA Labor Center. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, now let's look at how more undocumented workers than ever are now stuck in legal limbo. Federal immigration courts around the country are backlogged with nearly 500,000 cases. That's the biggest number judges have ever seen. California has the highest number of pending cases, and that situation really undermines the court's entire mission. People with weak cases can end up staying here in the U.S. for years, waiting for their day in court. And people with strong cases, well, they just remain stuck in the shadows. Dana Lee Marks is an immigration judge in San Francisco and president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Madeline. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, what has caused this big backup?
Well, the first thing I always have to say is that I'm speaking today in my capacity as president of the National Association of Immigration Judges, so my comments don't reflect the Department of Justice. But our association feels like we have been the legal Cinderellas, the ignored stepchildren of the Department of Justice for many, many years, and that adequate funding has not been provided by the department or by Congress in order to give us the number of judges that are needed to handle a burgeoning caseload. And the situation has just simply gotten worse and worse and worse over time.
But what's caused this recent increase, a nearly 30% increase from last year?
The 30% increase is over a two-year period. It's from the beginning of fiscal year 2014, which would have been October of 2013. That still is a staggering amount. In part, that has been a surge of unaccompanied children and families coming to the border from the Northern Triangle of Central America, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, as well as from Mexico. But it's also just been the fact that overall, the backlog has been growing because we have had insufficient numbers of immigration judges to handle cases, and the immigration law has simply gotten more and more and more complex. So cases are taking longer.
Mm. And so I thought, though, when those kids were coming across the border from Central America, I thought that the courts were fast-tracking those cases, putting those kids at the front of the line.
That is correct. Those cases are going to the front of the line. That leaves more difficult cases or cases that have been pending longer,
right,
pushed back to the end of the line, which for many courts is in November of 2019. And we're fearing that it might go out even beyond that in many places.
So on average, how long does someone wait before they have their case decided?
It really varies tremendously across the country because individual courts are staffed at different rates. But one figure I've seen is that the average is about 604 days to process your basic immigration case at the court.
Okay, so a long time. And then plus there are appeals and all that, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And then so I wonder if you could just paint a picture of what it's like in your courtroom. How many cases do you see, and how long does it take for you to dispense with each one?
Right. Well, we actually describe our caseload as being death penalty cases being heard in a traffic court-like setting. The reason we say they're death penalty cases is that if somebody is applying for asylum in the United States, they are telling the judge that they're afraid of serious harm, even death, if they are sent back to their country. But in contrast, we have a very high volume of cases. Judges normally hear an average of about 100 cases a week. Now, some of those are in an arraignment type docket where you're just kind of figuring out what needs to be done. Those cases can take anywhere from 5 to 10 minutes, maybe 15, depending on just what issues are being presented and whether or not someone is represented by an attorney. And then a percentage of the cases that a judge hears every week will involve individual merits cases, where it varies from court to court. Some courts will schedule two or three of those cases in a morning or afternoon session. Other courts will schedule only one. And based, again, on the complexity of the issues, that's when somebody presents their evidence. So it's really hard to talk about what an average is.
Yeah. Well, so what is it like for you, though, when you see people just an unending stream in front of you? I mean, how can you know very much about their particular case? And make
well,
an informed
what
decision?
A lot of people don't realize is that immigration proceedings, although they're conducted in a lot of ways like a criminal court proceedings, because they are civil in nature, people don't have a guaranteed right to counsel. And because they're administrative proceedings, the judge's job is actually much more difficult because it's our job to make sure that if somebody has a benefit that they can qualify for under the immigration laws, that we ferret out that information to make sure that we get the proper information to determine whether or not they're qualified. So it's very difficult to do in a rapid-fire manner, but obviously the judges are trying to do as much as they can, balancing the need to go as quickly as possible so that more people aren't stuck waiting years for their hearings to be held. And you have to balance that with the time it takes to get the information that's needed and to have the testimony both of the individuals themselves and sometimes of the witnesses they bring in order to make sure that we're making the correct decision in their case.
How confident are you, though, that you make the right decision when you finally decide?
Well, that's part of what adds to the judicial stress of this job. I mean, I think the best way to get a handle on how immigration judges feel is to realize that if you just take the number of pending cases and divide them by the number of sitting judges in field offices, take out our management, that's 445,000 cases across the country divided by about 210 sitting field immigration judges who are working full-time in their courts. That leaves us more than 2,100 pending cases per judge. Now, what does that mean? Well, you compare that to the average caseload of a federal district court judge, which is normally about 440 pending cases. The average caseload of a standard Social Security judge is about 500 cases per judge. A Veterans Appeals Court judge, which is another kind of administrative proceeding, they have about 700 cases per judge on average. So you can see that our numbers just are exponentially larger, and in turn, we're completing those cases with a lot less staff support than most of these judges. Immigration judges on average have about 50% of a judicial law clerk's time. That's a skilled lawyer to help you look at the issues presented in those cases. So it's a very stressful job, and in fact, a stress study of immigration judges done back in 2007, so it was during better times than we face now, showed that immigration judges are as stressed as prison wardens and busy hospital doctors.
Yikes.
Now, I think most people would be very surprised, Madeline, to believe that a judge's job is perceived as that stressful.
Dana Marks, I have to end it there, unfortunately, and my condolences that you are doing such a stressful job. I'm sorry for you.
Try to get Congress to give us more money, more judges.
Dana Marks, immigration judge in San Francisco.
Thanks so much,
Thank
Madeline.
You. Coming up on the show, what's the best way to get people to conserve water? We're going to find out from people who study our behavior and what motivates us, next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry, you can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're in a drought. You know you should save water. Shorter showers, brown lawns, empty pools could all help. But let's be real. How many people are actually making these changes? A new poll out today found 2/3 of Californians support mandatory water cuts in theory, but More than 4 out of 10 homeowners say they cannot cut back. So what would it take to close the gap between what we should be doing and what we're actually doing? Higher water rates, fining, public shaming, positive reinforcement. I'm joined now by two people who have looked into what works. Ken Baron-Claw is a public policy professor at UC Riverside. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. And Karen North, a psychology and social media professor at USC. Welcome to you, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Ken, let's start with you. We are trying a billion different things to conserve water here in the state of California. In your opinion, what is the best method?
Well, that's a good question. I think the story is that a number of different things can work, but they work to varying degrees, and each of them involves different costs. As an example, voluntary requests like we had from the governor last year to cut back on water use, they can have an effect. It's a pretty small effect, but it's also a pretty cheap thing to do. The conservation rebate programs tend to have bigger effects on people's behavior, but those have to be funded and paid for somehow by the water districts that offer them. And then, of course, there's pricing, which is the way that we effectively ration the use of most of our goods and services and resources in a market economy. And pricing can have a very big effect on individual behavior. In a study that we did with Eastern Municipal Water District, we found that their tiered rate structure reduced demand by maybe 10 to 15%. But prices impose costs on households, and sometimes they can impose pretty significant costs on disadvantaged households.
Yeah, so that's the thing. Rich people can probably afford to pay more, but aren't they the ones that use the most water?
Typically, yes. You're going to find that if you're wealthier, you're going to be using more water and have a greater ability to pay for it. That's actually one of the nice things about these allocation-based rates is that they look at your specific household situation, and they will allocate you some low-priced water, some moderately priced water before you get up into those penalty tiers, and they make those allocations based on your particular situation. And so there's an element of fairness involved in these allocation-based rates.
Now, I have heard that up in Northern California and Santa Cruz in particular, if you use too much water, you're sent to water court, like traffic court.
Well, I've heard that there's some pretty steep fines that have been imposed, and perhaps it also involves dragging you into court. I don't know of anything that's going on like that down here in Southern California right now, though. Not yet, anyway.
Yeah, I meant school. Like, you know, instead of paying a fine, you would go to traffic or water school, and then you would learn how to be a better water consumer.
Mm-hmm. So these are all costs that will eventually be imposed upon you if you don't do what your water district wants you to do in terms of water conservation.
Okay, so Karen North at USC, what do you think is the answer?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of answers and there are a lot of complications with this. Obviously you can get people to comply by either charging them or doing other punitive measures, but the challenge right now, I think, is to get people to be enthusiastic about helping, to people join sort of as a community of people who care about water. And for that, we need some more clever approaches to get people to join in together and try to be creative in their own lives and want to conserve water.
So positive reinforcement rather than negative.
Yeah, I mean, there's punishment, which is what the fines are, and then there's the basically you can. I'll give you an example that involves water, but not in the right way. Is the ice bucket challenge.
Uh-huh.
You know, why did so many people do that? Did they all care about ALS, or did somehow that campaign get people to care about a cause while engaging them in a fun activity? So if we could do the same kind of thing where we spread the word, perhaps through social media, by getting people to encourage each other and draw each other into a common effort, then people are much more successful because people will want to do it and they'll want to outdo their friends.
Yeah. I guess the ice bucket challenge wasted some water there.
Well, yeah, I know. But it's a funny example. But
but that also relied on celebrities doing it, too. Do you think that would be good if some celebrities got involved in this?
Well, you know, I mean, especially out here, when celebrities get involved, they have the celebrities and other influencers. If they get involved and they say this is important to me and it should be important to you, and here I am doing it and you should do it too, it's a great way to spread the word and to get attention to a really, really important issue.
What about drought shaming? People who are shamed on social media or elsewhere for their big green lawns.
So there's a big social media, there are people who are sort of like drought vigilantes who are riding around on bikes and cars with GoPros and other cameras, putting up YouTube videos of people getting water on sidewalks. And in all honesty, in whether it's your community online or your neighborhood, people don't really want to live in a place where shame from one neighbor to another is used to control behavior. So I think that that is sort of the ultimate negative way to influence behavior.
And Ken, back to you. What about, speaking of looking at the carrot rather than the stick, what about this idea of moral suasion? And I think in some areas they do this. They send out water report cards that tell you how well your neighbor is doing in terms of conserving water.
Yeah, so I guess you could think of it as private shaming, right? That you get your bill, and in your bill there's this report that shows you how much water you used and then how much water your peer group used, whether that's your neighbors or a group of households that have been determined to be similar to yours. And so in private, you see that you're either doing well or you're not doing so well. And there have been studies of how well this works. And a study in Atlanta found that it had maybe an overall effect of about 2%, a little bit more on consumer water use. But there was a study done up in the East Bay in San Francisco of WaterSmart home water reports that found closer to a 5.5% reduction in water use. And importantly, they didn't find that the people who were already doing well, those people didn't backslide. They didn't see that, oh, we're doing great, we can make less of an effort, and then they become more inefficient. Those people remained efficient, while the people who weren't doing as well as their neighbors tried to do better.
And Karen, one last question to you. Do you think there's a difference generationally in terms of how people conserve water or think about it?
Well, I mean, there are always generational differences. I think that one thing that we're seeing is that older people, and I don't mean old people, but people who are more experienced in the world and who've been through other droughts, can actually think through the ramifications of using water and are often more motivated to help out, assuming that they can. And younger people are more into their own experience, but they are also into sharing. So the idea of being able to share their best practices or their experiences can be a powerful tool.
All right. I want to thank you both very much. Karen North, psychology and social media professor at USC, and Ken Barenclaw, professor of public policy at UC Riverside. Thanks both.
Thanks, Madeline.
Thank you.
All right. What do you think? If someone called out your water use, would you want to use less water? Do you think public shaming works? Private shaming? Do you like the social media ice bucket approach? Call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Jurassic Park. Just a fantasy, right? Well, maybe not. Scientists have been able to sequence the DNA of the long-extinct woolly mammoth, and they're trying to bring back other animals to help reverse mass extinction. We'll talk about that after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The movie Jurassic Park came out back in 1993. Even back then, people were thinking about the possibility of scientists getting dinosaur DNA and bringing real dinosaurs back to life. Of course, in the movie, it didn't work out so well. No. Just last month, an international group of scientists announced that they've put together the complete genome, or DNA, of two woolly mammoths. So, is life preparing to imitate art? Will we soon be breeding woolly mammoths for a real-life theme park of extinct animals? Beth Shapiro is an associate professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at UC Santa Cruz. Her new book is How to Clone a Mammoth, The Science of De-Extinction. Welcome to the program, Beth.
Thank you for having me.
Well, talk about the reality of it, because, you know, on the face of it, when you say, oh, we can have the complete DNA sequence, it seems like it's just a matter of time before these big creatures will be roaming the earth again. But really, there is a long road to go between sequencing the DNA of these animals and seeing them in the flesh again.
Yes. In fact, I might go so far as to say that we will never be able to resurrect something that is 100% identical to a woolly mammoth or any species that's been extinct for a long time. There are many, many steps between sequencing a genome, just a long string of letters that make up the DNA, the sequence that makes you look and act the way you do, and actually creating a living, breathing animal. We don't know how to string together those long sequences and turn them into something that we could stick into a cell and turn into a living creature, for example.
But we did create Dolly the sheep.
Yes. So Dolly was created using a process called cloning. And this is actually a very specific scientific technique that requires something very important that mammoths and any other long-dead creature doesn't have, and that is a living cell. So when an organism dies, the DNA, the cells that contain that DNA, start to decay almost immediately by the action of bacteria or enzymes within their own cells, through irradiation by UV light, by freeze-thaw, water destroys DNA. Remember, these bones and mummies get buried in the soil, and the soil's full of microorganisms that are living creatures that chew up DNA. So when an organism is dead, it doesn't take very long at all for there to be no single living cell. And without any living cell, the process that we know of as cloning, this process that brought us Dolly the sheep in the mid-1990s, is not possible.
Well, could you take the cells from a living animal that is about to go extinct and keep those cells around and then try to bring that animal back?
Yes, that is something that is being considered. In fact, the Bucardo that I brought up just a moment ago is an animal that went extinct in the early 2000s. And before the last individual, her name was Celia, before she died, the Spanish team that was working on trying to protect her managed to capture her and actually harvest some cells and keep them alive, or at least frozen in a state where they could be revived. And they have been working to use that process of cloning to bring back this Bucardo. And this, in fact, is the closest that anyone has come to actually resurrecting a species that's gone.
And how successful was it?
Well, it depends how you want to, how you think about success. So they have created a whole bunch of embryos, and they were able to have one individual be born. But that individual had a major lung deformity and only survived for about 10 minutes. And it's not clear whether this lung deformity was because of the cloning process or just because of a completely natural error that might have happened during the development process. Mm. The team, they have been working very hard to develop methods to breed these rare species of ibex, not just to bring the Bucardo back, but also to protect other species that are in danger, to try to help them by increasing the numbers before they go extinct.
Such as, I could imagine, the mountain gorillas or the black rhinos or...
Right. This team was working specifically on the Bucardo, but there are other groups out there that are working on methods to increase reproductive success in a lot of different endangered species, and this is really important work. There's also a place in San Diego that's called the Frozen Zoo. It's actually part of the San Diego Zoo. And at the Frozen Zoo, they have been collecting specimens, tissue specimens, from living organisms for the last couple of decades and creating this archive of frozen tissues so that should it become possible at some point in future to use this, both to bring extinct species back to life and to increase genetic diversity in living species that are endangered, like the rhinoceroses and other species. Potentially, this could be an incredible resource for helping to save these species.
That sounds like a Noah's Ark, a modern Noah's Ark, or
it
something
is.
Along
it
those
is,
lines.
In a way.
So who decides which animals are deserving of trying to preserve and which aren't?
Well, the people at the Frozen Zoo have actually been working to collect as many different species as possible, not just looking at species that are endangered right now, but just trying to collect as much information from as many species are out there, and not just limited to animals. They're also thinking about plants and insects, other species that might be in danger of going extinct or become endangered in the future.
Well, as you write in the book, there have been 5 mass extinctions in the past. A lot of people say we are now going through a 6th mass extinction and that this one is man-made. I'm wondering if you think that we have a responsibility, because we've created this mass extinction that's unfolding right now, if we have some sort of responsibility to try to bring back as many animals as possible.
I don't think we have a responsibility to bring back species that are extinct. I think that we have a responsibility and an accountability for our actions today, and we have a responsibility to protect environments that exist today. It's very hard to bring something back once it's extinct, and it's also hard to know what the consequences to living organisms and living ecosystems might be if we were to resurrect something that's been gone for a long time. It's clear that if a species were brought back, that its reintroduction into a habitat, even a habitat that it once occupied, would definitely be consequential for everything else that lives there today. And I think this is something to consider very carefully. I would say that, yes, we are responsible for the increasing number of extinctions and the loss of biodiversity and habitat today, but our responsibility is to maintain those habitats that still exist and to try to create space for species whose habitats are declining so that they can survive.
So I wonder, since you are a scientist and a biologist, if you could talk about the process of doing this and how complicated it is. Once you find, let's say, a woolly mammoth tusk and you get some of the DNA from it, how do you go from that to a creature?
Well, the process that most likely would be used is kind of like a cut-and-paste job for a DNA sequence, for a genome sequence. We can't clone a mammoth because we'll never find a living cell. And if we need a living cell to clone, it's most likely, if we were going to bring a mammoth back to life, that we would use an elephant cell. Asian elephants and woolly mammoths are about 99% identical in their genome sequences already. They share a common ancestor in the last 6 million years or so, which means there are about 1 million to 1.5 million differences between them, pretty much the same as between us and a chimpanzee. We can't yet change all of those 1 million to 1.5 million places that we might want to change if we were going to make an elephant genome sequence identical to a mammoth genome sequence. But we can start by making a list of genes where Asian elephants have one particular sequence and woolly mammoths have another sequence, and they're different from each other. And then we can go into a genome in an Asian elephant cell and start swapping out those bits to remove the elephant version of those genes and replace in its place the mammoth version. There's actually a lab at Harvard, at the Wyss Institute, led by George Church, that's been working on using these genome engineering tools that have been in the news a lot recently, called CRISPRs, to swap out 14 different genes that they've identified where woolly mammoths and Asian elephants were different from each other. And they've been able to do that. They've been able to swap out 14 different genes, mostly involved with adaptations to living in the cold.
So as you say, it's not the exact replica. It's not going to be the woolly mammoth again. It'll be something else, something that is part elephant, part mammoth.
It would be part elephant. And I think that first phase, I like to call that phase one of de-extinction, just creating an elephant cell that contains some woolly mammoth genes, is a process that we can do. We can do that slowly right now. But the next part of de-extinction, phase two, which would be taking that edited cell and turning it into a living, breathing animal, is something that we very much don't know how to do. And this is precisely why we are not close to having a mammoth or a mammoth-elephant hybrid wandering around the countryside in Europe or North America. Elephants don't fare well in captivity. It's been very hard to get elephants to reproduce in captivity. When they do, they sometimes injure or even kill their offspring. We do not understand how to meet the physical and emotional needs of elephants in captivity. And until we can, this phase two, the process of actually bringing them back, is something that we just can't do, we shouldn't do.
Is there an animal that we could do it with more easily?
There are species that we have been working with for many years in labs that we have a more clear understanding of their reproductive biology and how to keep them happy, as it were, in the lab, things like mice and rats, etc. And perhaps starting with something like that would be a safer, a more ethically sound way to go.
What is the goal, then, on the part of scientists who are interested in this? Is it to just find out more about how evolution works and how DNA works and all that? Or is it actually to repopulate the world with extinct animals?
I think there are a variety of goals, and it depends on who you ask. There are groups that are working on species like the gastric brooding frog, who I believe really just want to bring this animal back because it played a particularly important role where it lived, and they're gone, and they're pretty spectacular creatures. They very unique gastric brooding frog would swallow its eggs, and the larvae develop into frogs within their stomachs, and then they just kind of throw them up when they're fully formed. A pretty impressive way of protecting your offspring from being eaten when they're still developing. And then there are scientists who are interested in bringing species back because they feel like their absence in a habitat is actually having detrimental consequences to other species. One of the motivating factors behind the group that's interested in bringing mammoths back would be to repopulate parts of Siberia with these large herbivores. There's a Russian scientist called Sergei Zimov who's established a place in northeastern Siberia called Pleistocene Park that he's preparing for the return of the Ice Age megafauna, including mammoths. He has so far put bison and horses and some different species of deer on Pleistocene Park, and he's noticed that just the presence of these herbivores is enough to stimulate the growth of the grasses that they need to survive.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think that another compelling reason to think about this technology might be not to bring a species that's extinct back to life, but potentially to engineer species that are still alive but in danger of going extinct because either climate is changing too rapidly for them to keep up or their populations have been through recent declines and they have little to no genetic diversity and there might be diseases that are killing them. We can't do any of this yet, and it's not as if there's a huge amount of money being invested in this. Any of the technology development that's going to this is going toward learning how to modify human genomes or for agricultural purposes. This is a thought experiment at this point.
So it's a thought experiment. Lots of people are going in different directions. And is there anyone overseeing this, or are there any regulations governing what scientists can and cannot do?
No, there aren't. This is something that, I mean, the technology, the genome editing technology, CRISPR, is incredibly powerful. And there have been a lot of recent calls for a moratorium, for example, on scientists actually using it to deal with human genetic modification. And as far as what's going on with bringing extinct species back to life, at this point, I'm not sure that there's a need to regulate what to do with them because we are so far away from actually having them. I think it's important that we have this conversation about what we might do, why we might bring them back, and what the goals are for doing this before it's possible. There are so many things in science that happen, and then you get to think about what the consequences of it happening might have been afterward. It's nice to talk about this way before it's even possible.
Beth Shapiro, she teaches evolutionary biology at UC Santa Cruz, and her new book is called How to Clone a Mammoth, The Science of De-Extinction. Beth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Warren Olney is here now, the
Hello.
Original artifact. Hello. You're not cloned. You are you.
Ah, yes, but I will be cloned soon. There'll be more of me than you could possibly count. We're going to do, speaking of large numbers, we're going to do a story today that I don't think has really gotten a lot of attention around here, but there is right now going on the worst bird flu epidemic in American history, and it's hitting various states. I think there are four or five states now that have called out the National Guard because there's so many dead birds that they have to be helpful to in burying them. Well, they are chickens and turkeys. And they're the chickens that lay eggs, not the kind that we eat, but the kind that we get eggs from. In Iowa and several other states, it's as a result, initially, they think, of migrating birds, and then nobody knows quite why the multiplication or the spread is as bad as it is, but it's huge. And there's a real concern about the poultry industry. There is not concern about the food supply, and they're very careful to point that out. There might be at some point if the broilers, as they're called, that's a third of the poultry industry, which is like a $45 billion industry or something. And most of them are in the South. So far, they haven't been hit. Those are the kind that they grow that we eat. And there's some concern that if it's migratory birds that are doing this, they're going to migrate again, and they might migrate there, and there might be another outbreak. So it's of concern very much to the poultry industry and to some countries that import chickens that aren't doing it anymore because of this. And a major story that, as I say, isn't getting a lot of attention.
Well, it will in the next hour.
It will indeed.
Speaking of food, do you ever go out to eat in the San Fernando Valley?
Not since I lived there.
Well, maybe you should make the trek over the hill because there is a new foodie scene there. We're going to tell you all about it next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Adeline Brand. I know I'm going to get hate mail for this, but I'm just going to say it. When you think of the San Fernando Valley, you do not think of great food. Well, maybe you will now. There is a crop of new hot restaurants that might give you a reason to brave the 405 or the 101. Catherine Spires is food editor at KCT. She's here now to tell us all about the Valley's burgeoning restaurant landscape. Hi.
Hi.
Well, we know about the sushi places. Those are world-renowned, delicious.
Absolutely.
On Ventura Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
We're not going to talk about that.
Right.
What are we going to talk about?
We are going to talk about gastropubs.
Oh.
Yeah, gastropubs are the newest thing along Ventura Boulevard, especially in the Studio City, Sherman Oaks area. And they are really sort of reinventing the culinary world of the Valley.
When I think of gastropub, I think craft beer and an expensive hamburger.
That's pretty accurate. Yeah, that about sums it up. Yeah, gastropubs are definitely known for their good beer lists. The ones in the Valley also have good cocktail lists because they're, you know, appealing to their audience. And it's upscale pub food. And some of the chefs there really are doing interesting things with the pub food. They're not resting on the old basics. They're really trying hard. Antonio Lofaso, she's the chef at one called Black Market. And she's well known because she was a fan favorite on Top Chef.
And what is her specialty?
She's pretty international. She has some Korean items on the menu. She uses a lot of Central American items. But what I find most interesting on her menus, which change fairly often, is that she takes the gastropub classics and kind of puts a new spin on them. For instance, deviled eggs. Those are a classic, and they're also a hot menu item right now.
And delicious.
Oh, they're amazing. She does hers with quail eggs, so they have a little bit of a different flavor. She mixes different things in with the yolks. Like right now, there's ahi mixed in.
Oh.
Yeah. So she's experimenting. Another thing that a lot of gastropubs do is just stuff on toast. And there's a place called Tipple and Brine that's another one of these new gastropubs. And they have some items like burrata and bacon on buttered toast. It's delicious, unsurprisingly.
Yeah, that's a lot of fat.
Yes,
it
is. How
could it not be?
Exactly. So that's a great one. Tipple and Brine I like a lot. At Black Market, Antonia, her toast comes with smoked trout and pickled vegetables.
Mm.
So good. Maybe not something that is the most approachable. She's definitely challenging her diners a little bit. And I think she's doing it on purpose. She grew up in the Valley. And then she sort of went off and chefed at all these hot restaurants in the city of Los Angeles and then sort of came back and wanted to bring everything she knew about food to all of her Valley friends and family.
And is it because the Valley has long been written off as a wasteland that people think, oh, well, here's an opportunity to make a mark?
Absolutely. That's definitely what's going on. Like the owner of Tipple and Brine, he's actually the vice president of the Sherman Oaks Chamber of Commerce. So he's definitely thinking about, you know, not just his own business, but like the bigger scope of the Valley and how it can be changed. And it's funny because, yeah, people do write it off as a wasteland. And for every time that happens, there's another person from the Valley who just unironically loves the Valley so much. I've never met a more proud people than Valley residents. They love it.
It's kind of like people from New Jersey.
Yes, yes, it is.
You know?
That's exactly right.
Okay. Cue next round of insulting, angry emails. I'm wondering, though, if these restaurants are made for the neighborhood or are they geared for outsiders to come in? Are they destination restaurants or more neighborhood?
I think they can be destination restaurants. I think that a lot of them are giving people a reason to go over the hill. But they are also meant, you know, there are a lot of young people who live in that part of the valley. And there's a lot of people who maybe aren't as young, but definitely have money to spend and would love to not have to drive all the way downtown to spend that money for really good food and drink. So it's keeping people...
And there are a lot of studios there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a lot of money that could be spent there if there's a place for people to spend it in that part of the valley. And yeah, that's what the gastropubs are doing for sure. And they're fun places. They don't feel like cheap knockoffs of places downtown or anything like that. They're all... If you go in on a Friday night, it's wild. It's packed. It's so much fun. They're great places to be on a weekend.
And is this primarily in the Studio City, North Hollywood part of the valley?
Yeah,
in
Sherman Oaks. It's definitely centered around Ventura Boulevard. Absolutely.
Okay. So gastropubs and sushi.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I did ask the owner of Tipple and Brian what his favorite restaurants were. And he's like, oh, we like sushi a lot. So yes, definitely still good sushi restaurants in the valley. But everyone should try gastropubs as well for your, you know, you might find a burger that blows your mind.
All right. Thank you. Catherine Spires, you have educated me on the valley. Thank you.
Thank you.
Catherine Spires is food editor at KCET. And Julie Myers is here with the listener feedback. Is
first,
it already negative about my
not yet no.
comments about the Valley?
I'd like to say something nice about the Valley. Boneyard Bistro, Sherman Oaks, one of the best beer selections in the city.
There you go.
So good. But let's move on to drought shaming, Madeline. We wondered if shame was a motivator for you all when it comes to saving water. Anthony Flores finds shame highly motivating. He says on Facebook that he cut back on eating beef and almonds, two water-intensive foods, because he doesn't want to feel like he's part of the problem. Robert Bonderer seems like he may be the one who is dishing out the shame, though. He ripped up his lawn, saves a bunch of money. He says, it couldn't be easier decision. Do it, people.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Julie Myers. If you'd like to tweet at us what you do to fight the drought, please do at KCRW Press Play. We're in all the end. To the Point is up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.